Michael and I are pastors of the English-speaking Lutheran Church, the Church of the Redeemer, in the Old City of Jerusalem. We've been there 4 years, and we work very closely with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan and Palestine, really the Palestinian Lutherans in the land. There are many Palestinian Christians in Israel and in the Palestinian areas as well. Not only Muslim and not only Jew, but also Christian. Last time we started to learn a song that I hope we'll learn by the end of the week well enough for you to carry home with you. It is a song in Arabic about peace, and it's a wonderful song. We sing it every Sunday at the time that we pass the peace to one another in our service. And the words are, Yar Abba Salami, Amter Alena Salam, Yar Abba Salami, Imla Kalubina Salam. The second time we sing it through, then you replace this section with Imna Biladna Salam. The meaning being, God of peace, rain peace upon us, fill our hearts with peace. And the second time, God of peace, rain peace upon us, give our land peace. So you're moving from hearts to land, a little moving out. So it goes like this, and those of you who were here yesterday can sing along to start with. We'll sing the first stanza only right now. Ya Rabba Salami, Amter Alena Salam. Ya Rabba Salami, Imla Kulubana Salam. The word salam is like the word shalom in Hebrew. Salam in Arabic is peace. Once again.
Ya Rabba Salami, Amter Alena Salam. Ya Rabba Salami, Imla Kulubana Salam.
Now this time let's sing the second verse, Imna Biladina Salam at the end. Give our land peace.
Ya Rabba Salami, Amter Alena Salam. Ya Rabba Salami, Imna Biladina Salam.
Join your prayers with many Palestinians who are praying for changes of heart and changes in their land.
We're going to show you two maps right at the beginning. One map is from the current issue of Christian Century, and it's a map produced by the Palestinian Authority that is said to be the offer that Israel made to the Palestinians July 2000, the Camp David talks. And it shows the area, the lands that were offered to the Palestinians, and demonstrates or shows why it would not have been a very advantageous settlement for the Palestinians. We'll show you that map. Then we're going to show you a 6th century map, a mosaic map from the Jordanian city of Madaba, just east of Mount Nebo in Jordan, just east of the Dead Sea. So two different maps that show two realities of the Holy Land.
Many of you probably are aware that that after the accords or the talks began to fall apart at Camp David, there was a sense that Ehud Barak, the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, had offered an unprecedented deal for the Palestinians, which was refused by Arafat. And it's probably important to realize that neither Barak nor Arafat on their own would have been able to have approved it. They would have had to have gone to their people, each of them, at which time it would have probably been altered in any case. But the details of this offer didn't really come out until later. But what we'd like to show in this map is that the basic plan was, this is the West Bank that you're seeing a picture of. So Israel, Greater Israel, is above, and you know, north and south, this direction. Yes, thank you. Very good. Okay, so you've got Greater Israel surrounding this area, but this is the area that is called the West Bank. And in the way that the offer was given, already you see these various areas of dark green and light green, which indicate areas that were under different levels of Israeli and Palestinian control. But in the offer that was made, you have really three completely disconnected areas that would have been Palestinian, sort of. Okay, so you've got another section here, and then you've got another section that is cut off there from this greater section down here. So, in effect, you would have had three cantons that were not geographically related. Would have had, although this is a small, you know, this isn't a very big geographic area in between, it would have been completely controlled by Israel. And so somebody wanting to go from here to here to here would have had to have encountered Israeli checkpoints along the way. Not only that, you see within the green areas these various settlements, which are Israeli settlements within these areas, and those were not being given up, but would have been within the areas. And they control, if you study that, you'll find that they control the water aquifers, the roads.
It's probably important to note that the roads are indicated in those light yellow lines that run through, and they're actually to size. You know, if you have a interstate map of the United States, for instance, you see the interstate, but they're magnified in terms of their actual geographical proportion to the rest of the area. Here, these are not magnified. That's how much area a so-called bypass road requires, because there's always a security perimeter on either side.
So there would have been 69 settlements within, which would have taken up 10% of these green areas, 69 Israeli settlements within the Palestinian areas. There would have been full Israeli military control over another 10%, an additional 10% of the green areas that you see that would have been Palestinian. There was a temporary an area by the Jordan Valley that was supposed to be under Israeli control temporarily, with an unspecified ending. All the borders would have been under Israeli control, and there would have been no refugee return within the Green Line, within Israel proper. No return of Palestinian refugees. That was an important part of it. Now,
and no Jerusalem capital?
Well, actually, there would have been Abu Dis, which was a little kind of.
There's a little arrow that points to it. There, so that is within. So that's essentially a village adjoining Jerusalem, and that has a view of the old city. And they even talked about a special walkway that would go from Abu Dis to the Temple Mount or the Haram al-Sharif, where Al-Aqsa Mosque is and where the Dome of the Rock is. So they would be able to, it would be sort of like Moses, they would be able to stand on Mount Nebo, so to speak, and look at the Dome of the Rock, but it would not be under their state sovereignty, though in essence they already have sovereignty of the Dome of the Rock. Well, I think I don't want to spend too much time on this map. Let me just reiterate that what's important to note is that if you have a landmass that's essentially oriented north-south that is divided into three areas that is controlled by the Israelis, and then to the southwest, not on the map, is the Gaza Strip. And that is also separated from the West Bank proper. And so you have great issues of mobility, you have issues of economic viability, because it, as is the case right now, if you want to, this map is already outdated. I mean, it's not a proposal that's on the table. And the Israelis occupy 7 of 8 metropolitan areas of the West Bank. And so if you have, point out Hebron. Suppose you're bringing glass. Hebron is a glass center in the West Bank. Suppose you want to ship a container of glass from Hebron to Jenin in the far north. You would have to cross now through many checkpoints, and several of those checkpoints you would have to, if you receive permission, you would have to unload the lorry, the truck, and take the container out, put it in another truck, in essence on the other side, and do this several times to get to Jenin. So, conversely, if you were going to Hebron for a wedding from Jenin, it could take you easily one day if you received permission to do that. It's going through all the checkpoints, finding other taxis to take you, because you won't be able to drive that distance or take one bus for that distance. So keep that in mind. And then the last thing is that we're going to take a trip from Jerusalem, specifically from Damascus Peak in the Old City, to first to Ramallah, which is just north of Jerusalem, and then to Jenin.
Who can travel on the roads?
Well, we are told that on the bypass, what are called the bypass roads, which connect the Israeli settlements, that Palestinians are not allowed. That's not 100%. I don't know what the situation is right now, but that's the general idea. So those are really for the use of the settlers and the Israelis, and Palestinians aren't really supposed to use them. I want to say one more thing about just a helpful image that Jeff Halper, who is an Israeli human rights activist, has used. Said, you know, when you talk about this generous offer that Barak supposedly made, and you say 95% of the West Bank was offered, then you have to pull away that 10%, which were the settlements, the 10%, which are the military areas. And you're finding that even if it were 95% really, that you don't need, if you're organizing a prison and you look at the floor plan of a prison, it looks like the prisoners have all of the area, right? I mean, they've got, you know, the dining hall and their cells and their recreation area and whatever else might be there. The guards maybe only have 5%, but they have the most important 5% that is meant and intended to keep those borders very secure. So when we were talking about 95%, that's the way that you might think about how that was organized very carefully, where these pallets are.
In that analysis of the prison, that's done by an Israeli Jew from Minnesota who's an anthropologist and teaches at Ben Gurion University.
But that area only looks like it's like 100 miles by 40 miles at that.
It's, I think it's longer than that. But the width is even is much more narrow when you go from Jerusalem down to Jericho. It's probably 20 some miles. There's a
keto.
Yeah, it's 10 kilometers.
It looks like about 8 inches. It's 10 kilometers. So 6 miles. Can someone hit the lights over there, please, and we'll have a little clearer viewing. Once again, we start with the reminder that what this land is about, what we're talking about, is peace in the Middle East. This is an altar that was decorated by the children of our congregation. And here's the second map that we were going to talk about. I'm sort of out of range here. It's the Madaba map from the city of Madaba in Jordan, and it is a mosaic about the size of this room, but the actual map is about one-third smaller than what you see on the screen. It's the city of Jerusalem. It's key. It's central, and it's making a political point that Jerusalem is the center of the universe. Because this was the city of Jesus, this was the city of the resurrection. And we're going to be leaving from Damascus Gate. This is Damascus Gate, and it has a curious history. In Arabic, the name of the gate is the Gate of the Column. And for centuries, maybe you've heard us say this about 3 or 4 times, for centuries no one knew why was it called the Gate of the Column. Until this map was discovered, it was lost, essentially. It was covered over because of an earthquake and because of invasion. It was covered over for centuries. In 1896, when they were rebuilding the church, when they were allowed by the Ottomans to rebuild this church in Madaba, they discovered this vast mosaic. And here you see a column. Here we can see it a little clearer. And right here is a Roman column, and that's why Damascus Gate in Arabic is called the Gate of the Column.
So we'd like you to think about that which was hidden coming to light later on as we talk more about Ramallah and Jenin in the present situation.
We begin at Damascus Gate. This is on a market day, and how many of you have been to the city of Jerusalem? So, a few of you have been there. I hope all of you have the opportunity to go. Right now is an especially important time. It's not an easy time to go, and not an especially safe time. Perhaps safe enough, but it's an especially critical and important time for Palestinians, an especially important time for Christians from around the world to show solidarity with Palestinian Christians in particular.
There's a soldier watching up there in this little window over the gate.
As soldiers no doubt have watched for centuries. We're just going to take a quick walk through the marketplace and the gate.
This is one of the major markets of the Old City for the Palestinians in particular. And one of the things about that to remember is that the economy, Palestinian economy, has been hurt tremendously by the, from the Intifada, but the things that led up to the Intifada as well. And the Israeli economy also is suffering. But at this point, the average income per person is about $2 a day. in the Palestinian sector.
In the West Bank.
In the West Bank.
This is inside the gate?
Yes.
So we're inside the gate, and right where this umbrella is perhaps approximately where the column was. We're taking a trip to Ramallah, which is a few miles north of Jerusalem, and we're doing it on the occasion of what's called a COCOP meeting, which is the Coordinating Overseas Partners of the ELC, Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, Palestine. And as we leave Jerusalem, we come to our second checkpoint. And actually, there may be at least two checkpoints prior to this one. We're coming to Palandia, where 2 years ago there was no checkpoint. We're at the intersection of an airport and a refugee camp. And this checkpoint becomes more and more a fact on the ground. So I think in a few years it could be a kind of boundary checkpoint where there's a kind of immigration, so to speak, control of people going back and forth. It'll certainly have a very permanent feeling to it. And the Coordinating Council, the COCOP group that I mentioned, are the overseas partners of the church, and they come once a year to Jerusalem to meet to talk about how they can, in partnership, work with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, Palestine, in cooperative ways. And this is a study day. We're going to Ramallah to see what has happened. The Israelis have just left the city. They had occupied it for, 1 month? 35 days. And the reason the Israelis, it's important to know that the reason the Israelis went into the occupied territories again was to try to contain and the infrastructure of terror. That's Sharon's term, the infrastructure of terror. And they tried that in a number of cities, and it's hard to say whether they succeeded, but without doubt they destroyed the infrastructure of civil society in the West Bank. That's going to be the legacy. So we've secured permission several days prior to these photographs to cross over.
Now, do you have to have permission to do the photographing as well?
No. Sometimes there's, when you cross into Gaza, there's a sign that says no photographs, but I don't think anyone.
Heard stories of people even at Calandia.
Depends what you're photographing. So if we happen to have seen a soldier beating somebody and took a photograph, and were seen doing so, our camera might be confiscated. But generally, the Israelis make it very clear where you can take photos and where you can't. So this is a line of people, and they're waiting until soldiers motion them to come to the actual checkpoint. So you come one at a time, or one family group at a time. Behind these men on the right, there are hundreds and hundreds of cars that are parked there. People who live in Jerusalem, who have commerce, who have business in Ramallah. They park their cars there, and they cross over. Or, conversely, they live in Ramallah, and they have the use or own a car in Jerusalem. And since you can't drive through, they maybe travel by taxi to this checkpoint, and then they either catch a taxi on the other side, or they have a car there as well. So when I say we secure permission to drive through. Here's some TV people that are having their car searched by soldiers before they're allowed entrance into the checkpoint area. This is Bishop Aniv Yunan. He is the Lutheran bishop in Jerusalem, the bishop of the Palestinian Lutheran Church. And even though we had written permission, the soldiers evidently haven't gotten word of it or are testing that permission, and he has to firmly insist that we do indeed have permission, where a couple of cars, vans actually, of internationals traveling along with several Palestinian clergymen. eventually we were allowed through.
It's really important also to realize that there's this huge line that's waiting to get through, and there's one section that is that's going through person by person.
Yeah, and the soldiers can decide to take a coffee break, and they'll just close down the checkpoint for 15 minutes.
So the point is not efficiency. It's really not, you know, well, let's have some more places and more soldiers so that we can get people back and forth easily, which they easily could do. But the point is to make it difficult to go and to delay people.
And so sometimes it's completely closed. Suppose that if there had been a bombing in Jerusalem, they will often close the checkpoints almost immediately. And so depending, no matter who you are, you won't be able to cross, even if you're an international or a diplomat. You won't be able to cross. You'll have to go back. There's a special sort of outdoor for diplomats, and that isn't even open all the time. That's a military control point.
These checkpoints have become more and more stringent, more it's less and less easy to go around them somehow.
And they're what are also called flying or rolling checkpoints, where the Israeli military will set up a checkpoint within Jerusalem. For instance, if there's a major security alert, or they'll set it up just to control who's coming in, who's going out. Let me just mention, this is Bishop Neve again, and this is Reverend Saeed Al-Buni, who was born in Nazareth but went to college at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, became a Lutheran pastor in Chicago, and then joined the Division for Global Mission, where he is the program director for Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and the Horn of Africa. So he has a lot of concerns, and he is the co-secretary, along with Bishop Menib, of COCOP, this organization I mentioned, and we're here in Ramallah. We're at the School of Hope and the Church of Hope to look at the damage that was done by Israeli soldiers when they entered the school to check for either terrorists or weapons. They, of course, found neither, but they did a lot of damage, a lot of vandalism. And it's important to say, I don't know what the dollar amount was. Let's say it's $45,000 or $30,000. Perhaps not so much money for a Westerner or for a Western organization, but what you have to grasp is that the damage that is done is damage that is done to the psyche, to the heart, to the spirit. That's the damage that is done, and it will take a long time for that pain, for those wounds to be healed over. And I'm really proud to say that the ELCJ is a church that works to heal those wounds, to bind the wounds, to seek reconciliation, not to forget what happened, but to seek a way to move forward with the Israelis, especially Bishop Menib, who has convened a group of Israeli rabbis, most of whom have a North American accent, and Palestinian pastors, and sometimes we are privileged and invited to come along. So we're at the School of Hope now, and we're listening to Pastor Ramez Azara, who's the pastor of the congregation. And what he's describing, unfortunately, he has his hand like this. What he's describing is that he was brought by the Israeli soldiers to the school to unlock the doors. We had signs. There were signs on the doors to the Israelis. If you want to get in, please call our pastor. He will let you in. Please do not bomb the doors and destroy them. They have small plastic explosives that they put on the doors and blow the doors out. And so, of course, the church and school wanted to avoid that. So anyway, he was brought down in an armored personnel carrier, and they went through the church. They looked at where the hymnals were kept. They looked where the Boy Scout equipment was kept. They looked everywhere. Then they went to the school. They had already done considerable vandalism at the school, though they had already entered the school. And there were still some doors that they hadn't blown open. So he's describing how he is forced to open the door. And he opens the door, and there's an Israeli soldier behind him who pushes him in. Of course, the purpose being that if there is a militant, if there is a fighter or terrorist inside, Pastor Azar will be the one shot, not the Israeli. And this is something the Israelis have repeatedly denied. They have used Palestinians as so-called human shields. And repeatedly we have heard stories of this happening, hundreds of times. And I have always found Pastor Azar to be eminently trustworthy. So I have no doubt that he is telling the truth. So eventually, and he had a very good spirit too, as he tried to talk with them, and tried to see the face of the enemy, to speak with them about what they were doing, to even find ways to maybe gain a smile. And eventually, they went through the school, the church, and they had told him they would take him back. Now, Ramallah was under curfew, so you could not walk the streets. You would be liable to be shot if you walked the streets. So they brought him over to the armored personnel carrier to take him back. And then they decided that he could just walk back. And he tried to explain that he didn't think he was safe to walk back. And they said, oh, it's okay. We'll call and tell them not to shoot you. And then they drove off. And imagine the fear that you would have. That was the only moment that he was really afraid for his life.
So what happened?
He got back. He lives about a half a kilometer away from the church. So he got back all right. But he was really nervous about that journey. And as part of that trip to Ramallah, we also went to Arafat's compound, which by then had been severely damaged. And our purpose was to meet as a delegation, to have Bishop Muneeb and Pastor Alabuni speak on behalf of the delegation, and to speak very much for issues surrounding peace, and to really ask Arafat to do all in his powers to stop suicide bombers, to stop terrorism. And then we came out. I just want to point, this is a Finnish colleague of ours in Jerusalem. Maybe we all sort of were relieved to leave. As you go out, it's a maze because everywhere there's sandbags. And so you're always sort of negotiating this maze to get out of the building. And this is Craig Kippel. Some of you know about Augusta Victoria Hospital, the Lutheran World Federation Hospital at the top of Mount of Olives. It's a very significant medical center for Palestinians, and also it is a kind of point for where various supplies and personnel are sent to village health care units in the West Bank, and Craig is responsible for that. He is the Jerusalem representative of the Lutheran World Federation and a Roman Catholic and part of the congregation. And this is in the compound. I just want to demonstrate that they had a large compound parking lot, about half the size of your normal Target parking lot. And they must have had many vehicles in it when the Israelis came in. And the Israelis, with these 60-ton tanks, just flattened the cars, all the cars, piled them up, drove over them, etc. And so there are about 7 or 8 cars just right there. There were probably 30 cars like that in the parking lot that by this time had been pushed to one side by Palestinian maintenance. I'm told that this is a Mercedes, and I'm told that was Arafat's car. And he's not going anywhere, though, so I don't think he's going anywhere.
Before we move to the next thing, I just want to, again, reiterate the importance of understanding the purposes that seem to have come out now for this entry incursion into the West Bank, which is now being repeated on a daily basis. It was advertised or put out into the public as this effort to get terrorist infrastructure to demolish that. And what has really become clear as the time has passed is that it was indeed the civil society that was being demolished. I just want to share an article from Amira Haas, who is an Israeli. Israeli-Jewish journalist, and wrote in Haaretz, one of the papers in Israel. It's a scene that is, and this was on April 24th. She already knew what was going on, April 24th. It's a scene that is repeating itself in hundreds of Palestinian offices taken over by IDF, that's the Israeli Defense Force, troops for a few hours or days in the West Bank. Smashed, burned, and broken computer terminals heaped in piles and thrown into yards. Server cabling cut, hard disks missing, disks and diskettes scattered, and broken printers and scanners broken or missing, laptops gone, telephone exchanges that disappeared or were vandalized, and paper files burned, torn, scattered, or defaced, if not taken. And it's all in rooms full of smashed furniture, torn curtains, broken windows, smashed in doors, walls full of holes, filthy floors, and soiled bathrooms. Then she starts to list the areas, the places that were investigated in this way. The education ministry, the higher education ministry, the health ministry, data banks of the non-governmental organizations and research institutes that were devoted to developing a modern health system or agricultural, environmental protection, and water conservation. Data banks of human rights organizations, banks and private commercial enterprises, infirmaries and supermarkets. They all were clearly the targets for destruction in the military operation called Defensive Shield.
We're gathered just below Calandia, that checkpoint. We're gathered to assemble a convoy of about 20-some vehicles and trucks to travel to Jenin. You remember Jenin was on the almost northern edge of the West Bank. It's in a fertile valley. And this is the patriarch of the Latin Church, or the Roman Catholic Church, Michel Sabak, and he is gathering us in prayer. We are an assembly of internationals and Palestinians who have received permission to go to Jenin shortly after the Israelis left the center of the city, the refugee camp. And one of the very important things to understand about Jenin is that for days, medical teams were not allowed access to Jenin, or relief supplies allowed entrance into Jenin. In fact, if you were flying into Israel and you said you were a doctor and you were going to be volunteering your time on the West Bank, you would be likely turned back at Ben Gurion Airport and sent home. You would be put into a sort of a day jail, and then you would be sent back on the first available flight. And this happened, we have personal knowledge of this happening many times.
Now, I've heard horror stories that there would be pregnant women in labor at the checkpoints, Palestinians trying to get to a hospital, and they would just let them deliver on the street and bleed to death or what happened.
This is true.
Many, I don't know the number exactly, but this is something that has happened repeatedly.
And what's very important is to understand that this is coming out of this very deep fear, I think, in the Israeli psyche about the threat of Palestinians to the Israeli state, the Israeli way of being. And it's, of course, directly related to the suicide bombings. And I think this is one way that the hatred, the anger is taken out on Palestinians. So it's most often not taken out on the actual terrorist, but it's taken out on civilians that have no part of the terrorism that has been perpetrated by.
One of our congregation members is a midwife in Ramallah. She's also an international, but she's living in Ramallah, and she has been working on a booklet that has good illustrations to give to expectant mothers, so that if they have to deliver at home, they will have some idea what to do if they're not going to be able to get to medical
husbands
care.
And wives, yeah. Now we're at the checkpoint going into Jenin, and we're waiting for clearance. As you can see, we're World Vision, we're Caritas, we're Catholic Relief Services, we're Lutheran World Federation, we're the United Nations. It's a large convoy that's entering. And you can see also it's a very productive land that we're driving through. I want to just point out this. This is an armored bulldozer. It's made by Caterpillar, and it's in the United States, in Illinois, and it's about from here to here is about 11 feet. So it's a really big, a really heavy machine. It has a huge blade. It also has a very impressive backhoe. And it was probably this kind of machine that dug around Bethlehem. I just read this in the New York Times. There's now a 5-foot wide ditch around the city of Bethlehem filled with barbed wire to prevent people from crossing, in addition to other security measures. And so this is the when we go into Jenin, this is the kind of bulldozer that did a great deal of damage to the housing in the refugee camp. But as we enter, I mean, these were kids that were just coming out of school, and they just started waving to us. And I'm just amazed at where smiles can come from in these circumstances. We parked outside of the central area of Jenin, and we're unloading tons and tons of relief supplies. NGOs, non-governmental organizations like Catholic Relief Services and Lutheran World Federation that were part of the development of the infrastructure, the development of civil society, are now really focused on delivering emergency relief supplies. And that's what's happening here. There's about a half dozen people from our congregation in Jerusalem that are with that convoy. And then how many of you have been in congregations where women of the congregation have put together quilts for Lutheran World Federation? These are quilts that are being delivered right here to Jenin. And this is a Syrian Orthodox friend and scholar, and he's really entered the 20th century or 21st century.
That's
And this is Patriarch Sabak again talking to people. This is, Nablus is a Muslim city, but very near Nablus there's a Catholic, small Catholic town. And so the two men on the right are from there. And this is the Catholics in this small town were really happy to see Patriarch Sabak come. This is Sandra Olwine, a member of the congregation and now an assistant pastor at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, helping with the unloading. There you can see we're doing what they do here, holding on the loading dock. Here we're a little bit more focused and serious mood, because this man from World Vision, who's their security officer, is explaining the security precautions that we need to take when we go into the refugee camp in Jenin, because there's unexploded ordnance left both by the Israelis and by the Palestinians. There was a thought that Palestinians had intentionally left booby traps. While they had, in fact, mined some of the camp during the Israeli invasion of their city, of their home, there weren't, so far as we know, booby traps that were left for internationals or for people coming back. But we had to be careful.
Rudolph Hintz,
who lives there now. And so we've entered the refugee camp, and let me just explain why the Israelis came there. Jenin, along with Nablus, was considered a hothouse of suicide bombers. They have martyr cemeteries, as in fact most of the West Bank cities, for people that are considered martyrs. They may be martyrs because they... during an Israeli curfew, or because they were suicide bombers. And it was known by the Israeli intelligence, which is very good because they have thousands and thousands of collaborators, Palestinian collaborators in the West Bank, that they have induced to become collaborators through, for lots of reasons that have to do with our humanity, not wanting to spend so much time in jail, wanting to have a job, not wanting our brother to be interrogated or possibly tortured, lots and lots of reasons. So they know, sort of what's happening, what's coming down, and they know that they're bomb-making factories, as they're called, usually rooms or a series of rooms in the refugee camp that are there, whose purpose is to provide an area to make bombs. So they came there. And at the very first day of the incursion, there were, I think, 23 Israeli soldiers killed in essentially two separate incidents. And the largest number were killed when they were trapped in a kind of courtyard area where they were searching all the apartments. What normally would happen is that a contingent of soldiers would come into a refugee's apartment. And then to avoid going out in the alleyway, which might only be 5 feet wide, they would put plastic explosive on the wall and blow a hole in the wall that would take them into the adjoining apartment. So they would go from apartment to apartment to apartment. They also use, in Jenin, this is well documented by Israeli human rights organizations, they've used human shields to lead the way into apartments or to go out into the alleys. And anyway, these Israelis were killed, and their comrades, their soldiers, were furious, and they took it out. They decided they had the wrong approach by sending in soldier teams into the refugee camp. So they used Apache helicopters made in the United States to essentially destroy this camp along with tank fire, and then as well as those large armored bulldozers.
Michael?
Yeah.
Can you comment on the extent of torture? Is it common?
I think it's much, much less than it used to be. I can't really.
Shortly after we arrived in Israel, so we've been there 4 years, there was a rescinding of the use of torture in the Israeli courts that had gone through. But it still happens. As we've seen them, but it's not supposed to happen.
So what you have to imagine is an area approximately 150 yards by 150 yards in the central part of a refugee camp. One of the things that's helpful, it was certainly helpful for me when we made our first trip to Israel in 1996, when we visited a refugee camp, when a Norwegian pastor asked the director of the camp, this is near Bethlehem, how long do refugees stay here? Would you say it's 3 months to a year? When do they find housing outside the refugee camp? And, of course, many of you probably know that many of them have been there since 1948, families. And so things get built up. They build a room at a time, a floor at a time. And so it's a small, compact city. It has an urban feeling to it. Many of the buildings are 3 stories tall with some kind of roof structure for sleeping at night and for gathering as families. This is a small, this is about a third of the size of that bulldozer, and this is one of two that were available to clean that huge area. What you have to understand is the rubble is about 12 feet deep. Now the Palestinians thought at first,
It's helpful to think, you know, this is not an earthquake site. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of what you think of when you see it.
Mm-hmm. How many people died when they came in and obliterated this?
The number is most likely around 74. Much less than what was
74 people.
No, at first the Palestinians claimed that there were, you know,
and
hundreds.
And then 23 Israelis. 74 Palestinians.
I want to just go back to this picture here. I just want to zoom in on that. Just see these women. They're sitting up. They're about 20 feet above ground level, and they're just sort of watching us as we go by.
Is the average Palestinian allowed to own a weapon?
Well, the security forces were allowed to have weapons. Now, the average Palestinian. The short answer, I guess, is that within Israel, no. I mean, they aren't even supposed to have knives that are longer than that are.
I'll tell you a story. Barbara knows that we regularly have things that are found in our chapel, and we put in the lost and found. I think she thinks we don't wait very long before they find their way to our house, but we do. And one time we found a very nice, sort of like a Gerber or Leatherman knife, you know, pliers, you know, it's about 4 inches long. So we gave it to the Hausmeister, the man who really cares for the church compound. And he said he couldn't take it because it has a blade longer than his forefinger. And if he's caught with that, he will be punished by the Israelis.
But the average Israeli is allowed and able to carry weapons. The average Palestinian is not.
But there are tens of thousands of weapons in the West Bank. Tens of thousands.
They're there.
These are people looking through the rubble, trying to find maybe some remnant of personal possession of theirs.
And how big an area was destroyed here?
It's about 150 yards by 150 yards, and there was damage in the periphery. But it's really important to understand it's a kind of concentrated damage there. So if you just go a block away, there's no damage whatsoever. Though there are various buildings that the Israelis, you know, destroyed, the police and security buildings, the radio station, things of that sort that they viewed as military targets. This is a car buried in rubble that's about 15 feet deep here. And everywhere we tried to make conversation with people of Jenin, and we were always well received and thanked for coming. Again, Sandra Olwein from the Christmas Lutheran Church talking with some children that are sitting there. This is an example of this apartment flat of a bulldozer that is sheared off the wall.
Question?
Yes.
How do the people get food to eat? Do they have jobs, or where do they get their food supply?
They
Well, it's a village, and so...
Jenin's a city.
Okay, a city. And so there's food that's just part of, you know, brought in and available for people. They buy on credit. They share with their... They have extended families, usually, and if somebody is low, they share. But I think the major thing is they buy on credit.
And they make do, and they are now receiving a significant food resources from international donors. This is, of course, a barbershop. It looks like a normal barbershop. You have the boy on the right who's sweeping the floor. What I didn't show in the photograph is that that there's no wall separating it from the alley, from the street, and business life continues. And then this is one resident who's not happy, who is wants to tell us what it meant for her and for her family. These are all her children there, what it meant. And so she's not happy at all, and it's pretty understandable. And again, we try to remember that what this is about is making peace in a land that's conflicted, but has not always been so conflicted, that there is the possibility of a shalom, a salam in this land, and that all of us need to work and pray for it.
We're right at 7:15, but I want to invite you to take here one of the articles that's going to be appearing in the July Lutheran magazine that has been provided by Fred Stickert. Offer Israel Tough Love, an American Rabbi Makes an Appeal to Christians. There are copies of that available. There's also a copy of an article by a woman named Grace Halsell, who is more of an evangelical, from an evangelical background, and she's writing about what Christians don't know about Israel. That's an interesting article. You're also welcome to, if you haven't received one yet, to take an olive wood cross. You can thread it on something and wear it as a necklace or give it to someone. And then there are these various books that are available and articles that are in the bookstore, mostly. Also, we've put out on the near the peace table out here some resources from that we've been collecting, just, you know, clipping things from Israeli newspapers, other newspapers, and I invite you at some point just to take a look at some of those. They're quite interesting.
Now, about 7:17 now. We're glad to stay here till Vespers. Oh, you have to, okay. But I would be glad to stay and talk if anyone would like to, or if you have questions. We can have a conversation now. Yes, go ahead.
How do your children,
you were the one to ask our children with us.
I mean, how do you, I'm going to be really blunt. How can you live in a place where you never know if your children are going to be okay or not?
Well, let me explain.
Vice versa.
In 1998, we received a call from the Church of the Redeemer, and we came down. We thought it was important that we come and see what it was like, because it was 2 years prior, in 1996, that there were some bus bombings, so those hadn't ceased, and we had this idea that it was a very dangerous place. So we met with people in the congregation, with Palestinians as well, a couple of Israelis, and they said, you have to understand that one of the things that unites both societies is the love of children. Children are really, we're not talking about Austria, where we used to live, where dogs were more welcome in restaurants than children. And so that gave us encouragement. We brought our oldest son with us also as a kind of interpreter for us and for his two brothers back in Vienna, where we were living, about what the situation was like, how it would be. And he was very enthusiastic about moving. So we came, and for the first 2 years, that is up until September 2000, we had complete freedom, and we went everywhere. We drove all over the West Bank and visited many, many places. Then from the end of September 2000 till now, it's become more and more constricted. So the children are in a kind of modified lockdown. They go from friend's house to friend's house. They don't go to West Jerusalem very often, except they go every day to school. Where the school is in a very dangerous area where there have been a lot of bombings. And so they're not allowed out of the school. School has recently gone from a wonderful wrought iron fence, open fence, to 10-foot high walls now, and with much security overview from the American and British consulates in Jerusalem. And our concern was, as for many people, was simply getting to school. That was the most dangerous time of day. We shifted the school hours around, but people pointed out that one terrible bus bombing was at 6:33 in the morning. So you're doing things that rationalize the safety. You're always making an assessment. And our children this past year had gone with an Irish diplomat who has an armored car. They've been driven to the school. We don't know what we're going to do in the fall. We'll have to see what the situation is like. But we're with a very good group. We have a very tight community of English-speaking Christians and also other international Christians. And we work together to try to find solutions. One possible solution is to see if we can convince LWF that Augusta Victoria would make a wonderful kind of satellite school. Because essentially there's no danger in East Jerusalem, except for times where there's Israeli crackdowns. In other words, obviously the Palestinians aren't sending suicide bombers into East Jerusalem. And so it's one of those things where you have to be very discerning, and you have to think, okay, what is Jerusalem? What is the Intifada? What is our family system? What is adolescence? All in all that mixture, try to be discerning about whether you should leave or whether you should have your children leave. Some children now are going to boarding school. For instance, the daughter of Craig Kipples, the LWF rep in Jerusalem, is going to boarding school this fall in England. And that's not a possibility for us, but we might have our oldest son for other reasons. The school is run by a Christian Zionist organization, and they've decided to sort of take it over and really put their stamp on it, as opposed to merely being the landlord. And that's a very serious thing for our community. We don't know what we're going to do. So our oldest son, who's in a special program, might go to Norway or Sweden to finish out the program. And we don't want to send them away a year early.
Right.
So we're trying to, you know, we appreciate prayers to the Thomas family and those that carried us along.
I think we get quite filtered news and opinions. Is AirPat good or bad for helping?
I think he's brought, at this point, I think he's probably good.
Mm-hmm.
He was unhelpful. He was certainly the symbolic force that carried the Palestinian banner for many years, but he's a revolutionary. He's not an administrator or a developer of a civil society or of a democracy. But simply because Bush said, you know, we're not going to deal with Arafat, which is what Sharon said, and Bush seems to be taking his cue now from Sharon, who has not shown himself to be a partner for peace either, that we're not dealing with Arafat. We want democratic elections and so on. Everyone wants democratic elections in the West Bank. Part of the Intifada was a kind of protest against the Palestinian Authority. That was one of the aspects of the Intifada, even though it was directed most
clearly against Israel, it's also directed against Palestinian authority. And so Arafat's role now is not a helpful one. But as soon as Bush says, you know, we're not dealing with Arafat, Arafat's popularity went from something like 37% to about 85% overnight. They're not going to let the U.S. tell them who to vote for, just as you wouldn't let Germany tell you who to vote for here.